He muddled his way up the stream bank, fuming. It took all his restraint not to turn back to the river watching Cither and shove his handsome alien face into the mud. Simon struck out across the valley, not with any idea of escape this time, but rather to walk off some of his restless irritation. His stiff-legged strides carried him past several more Cithi. Most walked by themselves, although a few strolled in unspeaking pairs. Some looked at him with unblinking interest. Others did not seem to notice him at all. One group of four sat quietly listening to the singing of a fifth, their eyes intent on the delicate, gliding movements of the singer's hands.
"Merciful Aiden," he grumbled to himself. "What are they thinking about all the time? They're worse than Dr. Morgani's."
Although the doctor, too, had been prone to long silences, unbroken but for his distracted, tuneless humming. At least at the end of the day he would unstop a jug of beer and teach Simon some history, or make suggestions about his apprentice's rather blobby handwriting. Simon kicked a fir cone and watched it roll. He did have to admit that the Cithi were beautiful. Their grace, the flowing line of their garments, their serene faces, all made him feel like some mud-covered mongrel, bumping against the table linens of a great lord's house. Though his captivity infuriated him, sometimes a cruel inner voice whispered that it was only justice. He had no right to be in this place, and having come, an urchin like Simon should never be allowed to return and sully the immortals with his tales. Like Jack Mundwode's man Osgarl in the story, he had gone down into a fairy mound. The world could never be the same. Simon's pace slowed from an angry march to a slouch. Before long, he began to hear the steady ringing of water on stone. He looked up from his grass-stained boots to discover that he had wandered right across the valley into the shade of the hills. A stirring of hope made itself felt inside him. He was near the pools, as Aditu had called them. The summer gate stood nearby. It seemed that by not thinking about finding his way out, he had been able to do what he had failed so miserably to accomplish in days past. Trying to imitate the degree of not caring that had brought him this far, Simon wandered off the path, angling toward the sound of splashing water, staring up into the overarching trees with what he hoped was suitable nonchalance. Within a few steps he had left the sunlight and entered the cool shadow of the hills, where he made his way up grass-tangled slopes carpeted in shy blue gillyflowers and white star blooms. As the song of falling water grew louder, he had to restrain himself from breaking into a run. Instead, he stopped to rest against a tree, precisely as if he were in the middle of a contemplative walk. He stared at the stripes of sunshine, lancing down through the leaves, and listened to his own gradually slowing breath. Then, just when he had nearly forgotten where he was going, did he only fancy that he could hear the rush of water suddenly increase? He started up the hill once more. As he reached the summit of this first slope, certain that he would see the bottommost of the pools before him, he found himself standing instead on the rim of a circular valley. The valley's upper slopes were covered by a host of white birch trees, whose leaves were just now turning summer yellow. They rattled softly in the breeze, like bits of golden parchment. Beyond the birches, the next level of the valley was thickly grown with silvery-leaved trees that trembled as the wind continued to sweep down toward the valley floor. At the base of the circular valley, in the depths within the ring of silver leaves, lay a vegetative darkness that Simon's eyes could not pierce. Whatever things grew there also took the wind in their turn. A sort of clattering whisper arose from the valley's shadowed deeps, a sound that might have been the scraping of breeze-blown leaves and branches, or just as easily the hiss of a thousand slim knives being drawn from a thousand delicate sheaths. Simon let out his pent-up breath. The scent of the valley rose up to him, musty and bittersweet. He caught the smell of growing things, a pungent odour like mown grass, but also a deep and intoxicating spiciness, reminiscent of the bowls of hippocras Morghenis had mulled on cold evenings. He took another whiff and felt strangely drunken. There were other scents, too. A dozen, 100. He could smell roses growing against an old stone wall, stable muck, rain puffing on dusty ground, the salty tang of blood, and the similar but by no means identical odour of sea brine. He shivered like a wet dog and felt himself drawn a few steps down the slope.
I am sorry. You may not go there.
Simon whirled to see a Scyther woman standing on the hilltop behind him. For a moment he thought it was a Ditu. This one wore a wisp of cloth around her loins and nothing else. Her skin was red-golden in the slanting sunlight.
What?
You may not go there.
She spoke his mortal tongue carefully. There was no ill humor on her face.
I am sorry, but you may not.
She took a step forward and looked at him curiously.
You are the Sothoraya who saved Jeriki.
So? Who are you? He asked sullenly. He didn't want to look at her breasts, her slim but well-muscled legs, but it was nearly impossible not to. He felt himself growing angry.
My mother named me Mayesa,
she said, making each word too precisely, as if Simon's language were a trick she had learned, but never before performed. Her white hair was streaked with gold and black. Staring at her long, coiled tresses, a safe place to let his eyes rest, Simon suddenly realized that all the Scyther had white hair, that the myriad of different rainbow colors that made them seem like outlandish birds were just dyes. Even Jeriki, with his odd heatherflower shade, dyes. Artifice. Just like the harlot women that Father Dreyosen had ranted about during his sermons in the Hayholt Chapel. Simon felt his anger deepening. He turned his back on the Scyther woman and started downward into the valley.
Come back, Seoman Snowlock, she called. That is the year, Dancing Grove. You may not go there.
Stop me, he growled. Maybe she would put an arrow in his back. He had seen Aditu's terrifying facility with a bow just a few mornings before, when Jeriki's sister had put 4 arrows side by side into a tree limb at 50 paces. He had little doubt that others of her sex were just as competent, but at this moment he cared little. Kill me if you want to, he added, then wondered if such a remark might strain his luck. Half hunching his shoulders, he strode down the slope into the whispering birches. No arrow came, so he risked a backward look. The one called Mahisa still stood where he had left her. Her thin face seemed puzzled. He began to run down the hillside, past row after row of white, papery-barked trunks. After a moment, he noticed that the slope was leveling off. When he found himself beginning to run uphill, he stopped, then walked until he found a spot from which he could look about and discover where he was. The entirety of the great bowl still lay beneath him, but he had somehow moved around the valley's rim from the spot where the Scyther woman stood watching. Swearing in fury, he started down the slope once more, but experienced the same feeling of leveling, swiftly followed by the resumption of an upward slant. He had gotten no closer to the bottom. He was still, as far as he could tell, only a third of the way through the ring of birch trees. Attempts to turn away from the uphill slope also met with failure. The wind sighed in the branches, the birch trees rustled, and Simon felt himself struggling as though in a dream, making no headway despite all his exertions. At last, in a paroxysm of frustration, he closed his eyes and ran. His terror turned into a moment of heady exhilaration as he felt the ground sloping away beneath his feet, tree branches slapped at his face, but some peculiar luck kept him from striking any of the hundreds of trunks that lay in the path of his headlong flight. When he stopped and opened his eyes, he was back at the top of the hillside once more. Maessa stood before him, her gauzy bit of skirt fluttering in the restless breeze.
"I told you, you may not go into the Year Dancing Grove," she said,
explaining a painful truth to a child.
"Did you think you could?"
Stretching her sinuous neck, she shook her head. Her eyes were wide, inquisitive.
"Strange creature."
She vanished back down the hillside toward Zhao E Tenokai. A few moments later, Simon followed, head down, watching his boot toes scuffing through the grass. He soon found himself standing on the path before Jiriki's house. Evening was coming on, and the crickets were singing by the river pond.
"Very good, Xioman,"
Aditu said the next day. She examined the shent board, nodding.
"Misdirection. To go away from that which you wish to gain. You are learning."
"It doesn't always work," he said glumly. Her eyes glittered.
"No, sometimes you need a deeper strategy. But it is a beginning."
Binnebik and Sludig had not come far into the forest, only deep enough to shelter their camp from the bitter wind sweeping down the plains, a wind whose voice had become a ceaseless howling. The horses shifted uneasily on their tethers, and even Kantaka seemed restless. She had just returned from her third excursion into the forest, and now sat with ears erect as though listening for some expected but nonetheless dire warning. Her eyes gleamed with reflected starlight.
"Do you think we are any safer here, little man?" Sludig asked, sharpening his sword. "I think I would rather face the empty plains than this forest."
Binnebik frowned.
"Perhaps, but would you rather also be facing hairy giants like those we saw?"
The White Way, the great road that spanned the northern borders of Aldeota, had turned at last by the forest's easternmost edge, leading them south for the first time since they had come down off the old Tumate Road with Simon many days earlier. Not long after the southward turn, they had spotted a group of white shapes moving in the distance behind them, shapes that they both realized could be nothing but Hunin. The giants, once unwilling to leave their hunting lands at the foot of Stormspike, now seemed to range the length and breadth of the Northland. Remembering the destruction that a band of these creatures had wreaked on their large traveling party, neither Troll nor Rimmersgarder had any false hopes that the two of them could survive an encounter with the shaggy monstrosities.
"What makes you sure we are any safer, because we have come a few furlongs into the woods?" demanded Sludig.
"Nothing that is certain," Binnebik admitted. "But I know that the small creeping diggers are reluctant to tunnel into Aldeota. Perhaps the giants may be having similar reluctance."
Sludig snorted and made the blade rasp loudly on the whetstone.
"And the Huni that Joss were killed near Naglamund, when the boy Simon was found, that one was in the forest, was it not?"
"That giant was driven to there,"
Binnebik said irritably. He pushed the second of the leaf-wrapped birds into the coals.
"There are no promises in life, Sludig, but it seems to me smarter to take fewer chances."
After a short silence, the Rimmer's man spoke up.
"You speak rightly, Troll. I am only tired. I wish we would get where we are going, to this farewell stone. I would like to give Joshua his damnable sword, then sleep for a week in a bed."
Binnebik smiled.
With certainty. But it is not Joshua's sword. Or at least, I am not sure it is meant for him.
He stood and took the long bundle from where it leaned against a tree.
I am not sure what it is for at all.
Binnebik's fingers unwrapped the blade, allowing its dark surface to show. The firelight revealed no more than its dark outlines.
Do you see?
Binnebik said, hefting the bundle in his arms.
Thorn now seems to think it is acceptable for a small troll to carry it.
Don't talk about it as if it were alive, Sludic said, sketching a hasty tree in the air. That is against nature.
Binnebik eyed him.
It may not be alive, as a bear or a bird or a man is alive. But there is something in it that is more than sword metal. You know that, Sludic.
That may be.
The Rimmer's man frowned.
No, curse it, I do know. That is why I do not like speaking of it. I have dreams about the cave where we found the thing.
That is not surprising to me,
the troll said softly.
That was a fearsome place.
But it is not just the place. Not even the worm or Grimrick's death. I dream of the damnable sword, little man. It was laying there among those bones as though it waited for us. Cold, cold, like a snake in its den.
Sludic trailed off. Binnebik watched him, but said nothing. The Rimmer's man sighed.
And I still do not understand what good having it will do Joshua.
No more do I, but it is a powerful thing. It is good to remember that.
Binnebik stroked the glinting surface as he might the back of a cat.
Look at it, Sludic. We have been so caught up in our trials and losses that we have almost been forgetting Thorn. This is an object that is making legends. Perhaps it is the greatest weapon ever to come to light in Austin Ard. Greater than Hernspear Oindoth, greater than Jukku's sling.
Powerful it may be, Sludic grumbled. But I have doubts as to how lucky it is. It didn't save Sir Camaris, did it?
Binnebik showed a small, secretive smile.
But he did not have it when he was swept over the side in Firanos Bay. Towser the Jester told that to us. That is why we were able to discover it on the Dragon Mountain. Otherwise, it would be at ocean's bottom, like Camaris.
The wind shrieked, rattling the branches overhead. Sludig waited an appropriate interval, then moved closer to the comforting fire.
How could such a great knight fall off a boat? God grant that I die more honorably in battle. It only proves to me, if I had any doubts, that boats are things best left alone.
Binnebik's yellow grin widened.
To be hearing such words from one whose ancestors were the greatest sailors mankind has known.
His expression grew serious.
Although it must be told that some doubt Camaris was swept into the sea, some there are who say that he was drowning himself.
What? Why in Osiri's name would he do such a thing?
Sludig poked at the fire indignantly. The troll shrugged.
It is only being rumor. But I do not ignore such things. Morgaini's writings are filled with many strange stories. Kinkeeper, how I wish I had found more time for reading the doctor's book. One thing Morgaini's was telling in his life story of Prester John was that Sir Camaris was much like our Prince Joshua. A man of strange, melancholy moods. Also, he was much in admiration of John's queen, Ebeka. King Prester John had made Camaris her special protector. When the Rose of Hernisadoc, as many were naming her, died in the birthing of Joshua, Camaris was said to be much upset. He grew fell and strange, and railed against his God and heaven. He gave up sword and armor and other things, as one who takes up a life of religion, or as one who knows he will die. He was making his way back to his home in Venita, after a pilgrimage to the Sankelen Adonitis. In a storm, he was lost in the ocean of Harcha Island.
Binnevik leaned forward and began pulling the wrapped birds out of the fire, exerting caution so as not to burn his stubby fingers. The fire crackled, and the wind moaned.
"Well-a-day," Sludik said at last. "What you say only makes me more sure that I will avoid the high and the mighty whenever possible. But for Duke Iskrimno, who has a good level head on his shoulders, the rest of them are drifty and foolish as geese. Your Prince Joshua, if you will pardon my saying it, first among them."
Benevik's grin returned.
"He is not my Prince Joshua. And he is, what was your wording, drifty. But not foolish. Not foolish at all. And he may be our last hope for staving off the coming storm."
As though he had stumbled into an uncomfortable subject, the troll busied himself with their supper. He pushed a smoking bird over to the Rimmer's man.
"Here, have something to eat. Perhaps if the Hunin are enjoying the cold weather, they will be leaving us alone. We can then gain ourselves a good night's sleeping."
"We will need it. We have a long road before we can give away this damnable sword."
"But we owe it to those who have fallen,"
Binnevik said, staring out into the dark reaches of the surrounding forest.
"We do not have the freedom of making a failure."
As they ate, Kantaka rose and paced about the campsite, listening intently to the wailing wind. Snow was blowing savagely across the waste. Flung hard enough by the howling wind to strip the very bark from the trees along the Aldeota's ragged north fringe. The great hound, not hindered in the least by such unfriendly weather, bounded lightly back through the blinding flurries, stone-hard muscles coiling and uncoiling beneath its short fur. When the dog reached Ingen's side, the queen's huntsman reached into his vest and produced a length of gnarled, dried meat that had at one end something suspiciously like a fingernail. The white hound crunched it in a second, then stood peering out into the darkness, cloudy little eyes full of eagerness to be moving once more. Ingen scratched carefully behind the dog's ears, his gloved fingers trailing across a bulgingly muscled jaw that could crush rock.
"Yes, Nikwa,"
the huntsman whispered, voice echoing within his helm. His own eyes were as madly intent as those of the hound.
"You have the scent now, do you not? Ah, the queen will be so proud. My name will be sung until the sun turns black and rotten and drops from the sky."
He lifted his helmet and let the stinging wind batter his face. As certainly as he knew that frosty stars shone somewhere above the darkness, so, too, he knew that his quarry was still before him, and that he drew nearer to it with every day that passed. At this moment, he did not feel himself to be the stolid, tireless hound that was his sigil, and whose snarling face made the mask of his helm. He was instead some subtler, more feline predator, a creature of fierce but quiet joy. He felt the freezing night on his face, and knew that nothing that lived beneath the black sky could escape him for long. Ingen Jegger slid the crystalline dagger from his sleeve and held it before him, staring at it as though it were a mirror in which he could see himself, the Ingen who had feared to die in obscurity. catching some hardy beam of moonlight or starshine. The translucent blade burned with a chilly blue fire. Its carvings seemed to writhe like serpents beneath his fingers. This was all he had dreamed and more. The queen in the silver mask had set him a great task, a task befitting the making of a legend. Soon, he felt it with a certainty that made him tremble. Soon, that task would be accomplished. Ingen let the dagger slide back into his sleeve.
"Go, Nikwa," he whispered, as though the hidden stars might betray him if they heard. "It is time to hunt our prey to ground. We will run."
Ingen vaulted into the saddle, his patient mound stirred as if awakening. The snow swirled, blowing through the empty night where a moment before a man, a horse, and a dog had stood. The afternoon light was failing, the translucent walls of Jiriki's house gradually growing darker. Aditu had brought a meal of fruit and warm bread to Simon's room, an act of kindness for which he would have been even more appreciative had she not stayed to annoy him. It was not that Simon did not enjoy Aditu's company or admire her exotic beauty. It was, in fact, her very beauty and shamelessness that disturbed him, making it especially difficult to concentrate on such mundane tasks as eating. Aditu trailed a finger up his backbone once more. Simon nearly choked on a mouthful of bread.
"Don't do that!"
The Scyther woman made an interested face.
"Why not? Does it cause you pain?"
"No, of course not. It tickles." He turned away sulkily, inwardly regretting his lack of manners, but not much. He was feeling as he usually did around Aditu, quite flummoxed. Jiriki, for all his alien ways, had never made Simon think of himself as a cloddish mortal. Beside Aditu, Simon felt himself to be made of mud. She was attired today in little but feathers and jeweled beads and a few strips of fabric. Her body gleamed with scented oils.
"Tickles? But is that bad?" she asked. "I do not wish to hurt you or make you uncomfortable, Xioman. It is just that you are so..."
She reached for the proper word.
"So unusual. And I have seldom been near your kind."
She seemed to be enjoying his discomfiture.
"You are very wide here."
She ran a finger from one of his shoulders to the other, sighing as this occasioned another muffled yelp.
"It is clear you are not made like our folk."
Simon, who had slid out of reach once more, grunted. He was uncomfortable around her, that was a simple fact. Her presence had begun to make him feel as though he had some kind of damnable itch, and in his solitude, he had come to both yearn for and yet fear her arrivals. Every time he stole a glance at her slim body, displayed with an immodesty that still shocked him to the depths of his being, he found himself remembering the thundering sermons of Father Dreosan. Simon was astonished to discover that the priest, whom he had always thought an idiot, had been right after all. The devil did make snares for the flesh. Just watching Aditu's lissom, cat-like movements filled Simon with a squirming consciousness of sin. It was the more terrible, he knew, because Jiriki's sister was not even of his own kind. As the priest had taught, Simon tried to keep the pure face of Elysia, the Mother of God, before him when he was confronted by the temptation of flesh. Back in the Hayholt, Simon had seen that face in hundreds of paintings and sculptures, in countless candlelit shrines. But now he was alarmed to find his memory turning traitor. In recollection, the eyes of Osiris' sainted mother seemed more playful and more feline than could possibly be proper or holy. Despite this discomfort, in his loneliness he was still grateful to Aditu for all her attentions, however perfunctory he sometimes thought them to be, and however careless of Simon's feelings her teasing sometimes became. He was most grateful for the meals. Jariki was seldom at home of late, and Simon was more than a little uncertain about which of the fruits, vegetables, and less familiar plants growing in the prince's extensive forest gardens could be safely eaten. There was no one but the prince's sister on whom he could rely. Even among the first family, the root and bough, as Jariki had phrased it, there seemed to be nothing like servants. Everyone fended for themselves, as befitted the Scythi's solitary habits. Simon knew that the Scythi kept animals, or rather that the valley was full of animals that came when they were called. The goats and sheep must allow themselves to be milked, for the meals Aditu brought him often included fragrant cheeses. But the Scythi seemed to eat no meat. Simon often thought longingly about all those trusting animals, wandering the paths of Zhao E Tenukai. He knew he would never dare do anything about it, but Aiden, wouldn't a leg of mutton be a fine thing to have? Aditu poked him again. Simon stolidly ignored her. She got up and walked past the nest of soft blankets that was Simon's bed, stopping before the billowing blue wall. The wall had been scarlet when Jariki first brought him, but Simon's Scyther host had somehow changed its color to this more soothing cerulean. When Aditu brushed it with her long-fingered hand, the fabric slid away like a drawn curtain, revealing another, larger room beyond.
"Let us return to our game," she said. "You are too serious, man-child."
"I will never be able to learn it," Simon muttered.
"You do not apply yourself. Jariki claims you have a good mind, although my brother has been wrong before."
Aditu reached into a fold in the wall and produced a crystal sphere which began to glow at her touch. She placed it on a simple tripod of wood, letting its light spread through the darkened room, then took a carved wooden case from beneath the colorful shent board, and removed the polished stones that served as playing pieces.
"I think I had just made myself an acre of woodlarks. Come, Siomen, play, and don't pout. You had a good idea the other day, a very clever idea, fleeing that which you truly sought."
She stroked his arm, making the hairs stand up, and gave him one of her strange, Scythi smiles, full of impenetrable significance.
"Siomen has other games to play tonight."
Jariki stood in the doorway, dressed in what appeared to be ceremonial attire, an intricately embroidered robe in varied shades of yellow and blue. He wore soft grey boots. His sword Indriju dangled at his hip in a scabbard of the same grey stuff, and three long white heron feathers were braided into his hair.
"He has received a summons."
Aditu carefully set the pieces on the board.
"I shall have to play by myself then, unless you are staying, Willow Switch."
She gazed from beneath lowered lids. Jariki shook his head.
"No, sister, I must be Siomen's guide."
"Where am I going?" Simon asked. "Summoned by who?"
"By First Grandmother."
Jariki lifted his hand and made a brief but solemn gesture.
"Amarasu, the shipborn, has asked to see you."
Walking in silence beneath the stars, Simon thought about the things he had seen since leaving the Hayholt. To think that once he had feared he would live and die a castle drudge. Was there to be no end to the strange places he must go, to the strange people he must meet? Amarasu might be able to help him, but still he was growing weary of strangeness. Then again, he realized with a flutter of panic, if Amarasu or some other did not come to his aid, the lovely but limited vistas of Zhao E Tenukai might be all he would ever see again. But the strangest thing, he thought suddenly, was that no matter where he went or what he saw, he always seemed to remain the same old Simon. A little less mooncalfish, perhaps, but not very different from the clumsy kitchen boy who had lived at the Hayholt. those distant, peaceful days, seemed utterly gone, vanished without hope of reclamation. But the Simon who had lived them was still very much present. Morghenis had told him once to make his home in his own head. That way, home could never be taken from him. Was this what the doctor meant? To be the same person no matter where you went, no matter what madness occurred? Somehow, that didn't seem quite right.
"I will not burden you with instructions," Jiriki said suddenly, startling him. "There are special rites to be performed before meeting the first grandmother. But you do not know them, nor could you perform all of them, even if they were told to you. I do not think that cause to worry, however. I believe Amaterasu wishes to see you because of who you are and what you have seen, not because she wishes to watch you perform the 6 songs of respectful request."
"The 6 what?"
"It is not important. But remember this. Although First Grandmother is of the same family as Aditu and myself, we are both children of the last days. Amaterasu Shipborn was one of the first speaking creatures to set foot on Austin Ard. I say this not to frighten," he added hurriedly, seeing Simon's distressed, moonlit expression, "but only to have you know. She is different even than my father and mother."
The silence returned as Simon pondered this. Could the handsome, sad-faced woman he had seen really be one of the oldest living things in the world? He did not doubt Jiriki, but his own wildest thoughts stretched to their limits, still could not encompass the prince's words. The winding path led them across a stone bridge. Once over the river, they made their way into the more heavily wooded part of the valley. Simon did his best to take note of what paths they took, but found that the memories quickly melted away, insubstantial as starlight. He remembered only that they crossed several more streams, each seeming slightly more melodious than the last, until they finally entered into a part of the forest that seemed quieter. Among these thickly knotted trees, even the cricket songs were hushed. The tree branches swayed, but the wind was silent. When they finally stopped, Simon found to his surprise that they stood before the tall, cobwebbed tree he had found in his first attempt at escape. Faint lights shone through the tangle of silken threads, as though the great tree wore a glowing cloak.
"I was here before,"
Simon said slowly. The warm, still air made him feel at once drowsy and yet keenly alert. The prince looked at him and said nothing, but led him toward the oak. Jiriki set his hand to the moss-covered door, set so deeply into the bark that the tree might have grown around it.
"We have permission," he said quietly.
The door swung silently inward. Beyond the doorway was an impossible thing, a narrow hallway that stretched away before him, as silk-tangled as the front of the oak house. Tiny lights no larger than fireflies burned within the matted threads, filling the passageway with their flickering light. Simon, who could have sworn guiltlessly on a holy tree that nothing lay behind the spreading oak but more trees, took a step back through the doorframe to see where such a hallway could possibly be hidden. Could it pass down into the ground somehow? But Jiriki took his elbow and gently steered him across the threshold once more. The door fell shut behind them. They were completely surrounded by lights and silken webs, as though they moved through the clouds and among the stars. The curious sleepiness was still upon Simon. Every detail was sharp and clear, but he had no idea how long they spent walking in the scintillant passage. They came at last to a more open place, a chamber that smelled of cedar and plum blossoms and other scents more difficult to identify. The minute and inconstant lights were fewer here, and the wide room was full of long, shuddery shadows. From time to time the walls creaked, as though he and Jurikee stood in the hold of a ship, or inside the trunk of a tree far larger than any Simon had ever seen. He heard a sound as of water slowly dripping, like the last drops of a rainstorm trickling from willow branches into a pool. Half-visible shapes lined the dark walls, things shaped like people. They might have been statues, for they were certainly very still. As Simon stared, his eyes not yet adjusted to the diminished light, something brushed against his leg. He jumped and cried out, but a moment later the flickering lights showed him a waving tail that could only belong to a cat. The creature swiftly vanished into the darkness along the walls. Simon caught his breath. Strange as the place was, he decided, there was nothing truly frightening about it. The shadowy chamber had an air of warmth and serenity, unlike anything he had experienced thus far in Zhao E Tanukai. Judith, the Hayhold's plump kitchen mistress, would almost have called it cozy.
"Welcome to my house," a voice said from the darkness.
The pinpricks of light grew brighter around one of the shadowy figures, revealing a white-haired head and the back of a tall chair.
"Come closer, man-child. I can see you there, but I doubt you can see me. First grandmother has very sharp sight," Jurikee said.
Simon thought he could detect a trace of amusement in the Sither's voice. He stepped forward. The golden light revealed the ancient, yet youthful face he had seen in Jurikee's mirror.
"You are in the presence of Amarasu Isenditu no Iseronsare, the shipborn," intoned Jurikee from behind him. "Show respect, Seaman Snorlock."
Simon felt no compunction about doing so. He kneeled on wobbling legs and lowered his head before her.
"Stand up, mortal boy," she said quietly.
Her voice was deep and smooth. It tugged at Simon's memory. Had their short contact through the mirror burned itself so deeply on his mind?
She murmured. "You are taller even than my young willow switch. Will you find the man-child's stool, Jurikee, so I do not have to stare up at him? Get yourself one, too."
When Simon was seated beside Jurikee, Amarasu inspected him carefully. Simon felt suddenly tongue-tied, but curiosity vied with shyness. He stole return glances, while doing his best to avoid her almost frighteningly deep eyes. She was much as he remembered her, shining white hair, skin tight stretched over her fine bones. Other than the measureless depths of her stare, the only hint of the immense age to which Jurikee had alluded was in the careful deliberation with which she essayed every movement, as though her skeleton were fragile as dried parchment. Still, she was very beautiful. Caught in the web of her regard, Simon imagined that in the dawn of the world, Amarasu might have been as terrifyingly, blindingly splendid to look upon as the face of the sun.
"So," she said finally, "you are out of your depths, little fish."
Simon nodded.
"Are you enjoying your visit to Zhao E Tanukai? You are one of the first of your kind to come here."
Jurikee sat up straighter.
"One of the first, wise Amarasu? Not the first?"
She ignored him, keeping her gaze fixed on Simon. He felt himself drawn gently but helplessly into her spell of command. A wriggling fish pulled inexorably toward the water's blinding surface.
"Speak, man-child. What do you think?"
I am honored to visit," he said at last, then swallowed. His throat was very dry. "Honored, but I don't want to stay in this valley. Not forever."
Amarasu leaned back in her chair. He felt himself held more loosely, though the power of her presence was still strongly upon him.
I am not surprised.
She took a long breath, smiling sadly.
But you would have to be prisoned here a long while before you would be as weary of this life as I am.
Juriki stirred.
Should I leave first, grandmother?
His question gave Simon a faint tremor of fright. He could feel the Scyther woman's great kindness and great pain. But she was so fearfully strong. He knew that if she wished, she could keep him here forever, just with the power of her voice and those compelling labyrinthine eyes.
Should I leave? Juriki asked again.
I know it pains you to hear me speak so, Willow Switch,
Amarasu said.
But you are dearest of all my young ones, and you are strong. You can hear truth.
She shifted slowly in her chair, long-fingered hands settling on the breast of her white robe.
You too, man-child, have known loss. That is in your face. But though every loss is grave, the lives as well as losses of mortals appear and fade as swiftly as the seasons turn the leaves. I do not mean to be cruel. Neither do I seek pity. But not you or any other mortal has seen the dry centuries roll past, the hungry millennia, seen the very light and color sucked out of your world until nothing remains but useless memories.
Strangely, as she spoke, her face seemed to grow more youthful, as though her grief were the most vital thing left in her. Now Simon could see much more than a hint of her former splendor. He lowered his head, unable to speak.
Of course you have not, she said,
a slight tremor in her voice.
I have. That is why I am here, in the dark. It is not that I fear the light, or that I am not strong enough to stand day's brightness.
She laughed, a sound like a whippoorwill's mournful call.
No. It is only that in darkness I can see the lost days and faces of the past more clearly.
Simon looked up. You had two sons, he said quietly. He had realized why her voice seemed so familiar.
One of them went away.
Amarasu's face hardened.
Both of them are gone. What have you told him, Juriki? These are not tales for the small hearts of mortals.
I told him nothing, first grandmother.
She leaned forward intently.
Tell me of my sons. What old legends do you know?
Simon swallowed.
One son was hurt by a dragon. He had to go away. He was burned, like me.
He touched his own scarred cheek.
The other is the Storm King.
As he whispered this last, Simon looked around, as though something might step toward him out of the deep shadows. The walls creaked and water dripped, but that was all.
How do you know this?
I heard your voice in a dream.
Simon searched for words.
You spoke in my head for a long time, when I was sleeping.
The Scyther woman's beautiful face was grave. She stared at him as though something hidden within him threatened her.
Do not be afraid, man-child, she said at last,
reaching out with her slender hands.
Do not fear, and forgive me.
Amarasu's cool, dry fingers touched Simon's face. The light streamed like shreds of lightning, then flickered and faded, dropping the chamber into utter darkness. Her grip seemed to tighten. The blackness sang. There was no pain, but somehow Amoursu was inside his head, a forceful presence so intimately connected to him at that moment that he felt shockingly, terrifyingly raw, an exposure far more profound than any merely physical nakedness. Sensing his terror, she calmed him, cradling his secret self like a panicking bird until he was no longer afraid. First grandmother then began to pick delicately through his memories, probing him with gentle but purposeful thoroughness. Dizzy snatches of thought and dream fluttered past, swirling like flower petals in a windstorm. Morgane's and his countless books. Miriamel's singing. Seemingly meaningless fragments of conversation from Simon's days in the Hayholt. The Knight of Thistleborg and the dreadful grey sword spread through his mind like a dark stain, followed by the silver face of Atuku and the three swords from his vision in the House of Jaloi. Plump Skodi, and the thing that had laughed in the courtyard flames, whirled and melted into the lunacy of the Uden Tree, and the emotionless eyes of the great white worm Ikjarjuk. Thorn was there too, a black slash across the light of recollection. As the memories flew by, he again felt the burning pain of the dragon's blood, and the fearful sense of connection to the spinning world. The sickening vastness of the hope and pain of all living things. At last, like the tatters of a dream, the pictures faded. The lights came back slowly. Simon's head was cradled in Jariki's lap. The wound on his cheek was throbbing.
"Forgive me, First Grandmother," Jariki said, as though from a great distance. "But was that necessary? He would have told you all he knew."
Amoursu was silent for a long time. When she spoke, it was with great effort. Her voice seemed older than before.
"He could not have told me all, Willow Switch. Those things that to me seem most important, he is not even aware that he knows."
She turned her eyes down to Simon, her face full of weary kindness.
"I am truly sorry, man-child. I had no right to plunder you that way. But I am old and frightened, and I have little patience left. Now, I am more frightened than ever."
She tried to pull herself up. Jariki reached out to help, and she rose unsteadily from her chair and vanished into the shadows. She returned a moment later, with a cup of water, which she held to Simon's lips with her own hands. He drank thirstily. The water was cold and sweet, with just a savor of wood and earth, as though it had been scooped from the trunk of a hollow tree. In her white robe, Simon thought, Amoursu looked like some pale and radiant saint from a church picture.
"What did you do?"
he asked as he sat up. There was a buzzing sound in his ears, and small shining flecks dancing before his eyes.
"Learned what I needed to learn," Amoursu said. "I knew that I had seen you in Jariki's mirror, but I thought that a fluke, a mischance, the road of dreams has changed much of late, and has become as obscure and unpredictable to even the experienced, as it once was for those who only traveled it in sleep. I see now that our earlier meeting was no accident of fate."
"Do you mean that your meeting with Simon was intended by someone, First Grandmother?"
Jariki said.
"No. I mean only that the boundaries between those worlds and ours are beginning to weaken. Someone like this man-child, who has been pulled one way and another, who through true chance or some unimaginable design has been dragged into many powerful
and dangerous connections between the dream world and the waking.
She trailed off, seating herself carefully once more before continuing.
It is as though he lived on the edge of a great wood. When the trees begin to spread outward, it is his house that first has roots across the threshold. When the wolves of the forest begin to grow hungry, it is beneath his window that they first come howling.
Simon struggled to speak. What did you learn from my memories about Ineluki? Her face became impassive.
Too much. I believe I now understand my son's terrible, subtle design. But I must think a while longer. Even in this hour, I must not be frightened into foolish haste.
She lifted a hand to her brow.
If I am correct, our danger is graver than we ever guessed. I must speak to Shima Onari and Likimea. I only hope they listen. And the time has not passed us by. We may be starting to dig the well as our houses burn down.
Jiriki helped Simon sit up.
My father and mother must listen. Everyone knows your wisdom, First Grandmother.
Amaterasu smiled sadly.
Once, the women of the House Sahonsare were the keepers of lore. The final word belonged to the eldest of the house. When Genji Yanna of the Nightingales saw the right of things, she spoke, and it was so. Since the flight, things have changed.
Her hand fluttered in the air like a bird alighting.
I am certain your mother will listen to reason. Your father is good, Jiriki. But in some ways, he dwells even more deeply in the past than I do.
She shook her head.
Forgive me. I am weary, and I have much to think about. Otherwise, I would not talk so uncarefully, and especially in front of this boy.
She extended her hand towards Simon, brushing his cheek with her fingertip. The pain of his old burn became less. As he looked at her solemn face and the weight she seemed to carry, he reached up and touched her retreating hand.
Jiriki spoke to you truthfully, man-child, she said. For better or for worse, you have been marked. I only wish I could give you some word to help you on your journey.
The light faded again. Simon let Jiriki lead him out in darkness. Chapter 26 Painted Eyes. Miriam L. leaned across the railing, watching the bustle and activity of the docks. Vinitin was not a large island, but its ruling Benedrivine house had provided Naban's final two imperators, as well as its three dukes under Prester John's kingship. It had also been the birthplace of the legendary Camaris. But even so great a knight was accorded only a middling high place in Venita's luminous hero-studded history. The port was a busy one. With Benegaris on the ducal throne, the fortunes of Venita still ran high. Aspites Previs and his captain had gone down into the town to accomplish their business. What that might be, Miriam L. could not say. The Earl had intimated that he had some important mission direct from Duke Benegaris, but that was as far as he would discuss the subject. Aspites had bade both Miriam L. and Cadrach stay on board until he returned. suggesting that the port was not the place for a noble lady to wander, and that he had not enough men-at-arms available to handle his own affairs safely, and still detach a pair of soldiers for their protection. Miriamel knew what this meant. Whatever Aspytus thought of her, however he valued her beauty and company, he did not intend to give her the chance to slip away. Perhaps he harbored some doubts about her story, or simply worried that she might be persuaded to leave by Cadrach, who had made little attempt to disguise his growing hatred of the Earl of Aedna and Drina. She sighed, gazing sadly at the rows of tented booths that ran along the dock front, each one festooned with flags and crammed with goods for sale. Hawkers cried their wares as they shuffled along the road, carrying their stock on their backs in huge overstuffed bags. Dancers and musicians performed for coins, and the sailors of various boats mingled with Venita's residents in a shouting, laughing, swearing throng. Despite the dark skies and intermittent flurries of rain, the crowds that swarmed the waterfront seemed bent on making a cheerful ruckus. Miriamel's heart ached to join them. Cadrach stood beside her, pink face paler than usual. The monk had not spoken much since Aspytes' pronouncement. He had watched the Earl's party leave the Aedna cloud with much the same sour expression as he now leveled on the activity below.
"God," he said, "but it makes a man sick to see such heedlessness."
It was not exactly clear what his remark addressed, but Miriamel felt it rankle nonetheless.
"And you," she snapped, "you are better? A drunkard and coward?"
Cadrach's large head came around, moving as ponderously as a mill wheel.
"It is my very heedfulness that makes me so, lady. I have watched too carefully."
"Watched what? Oh, never mind. I am not in the mood for one of your roundabout lectures."
She shivered with anger, but could not summon the sense of righteousness she sought. Cadrach had grown more remote over the last few days, observing her from what seemed a disapproving distance. This irritated her, but the continuing flirtation between herself and the Earl made even Miriamel somewhat uncomfortable. It was hard to feel truly justified in her irritation, but it was harder still to have Cadrach's grey eye staring at her as though she were a child or a misbehaving animal.
"Why don't you go and complain to some of the sailors?" she said at last. "See how well they'll listen to you."
The monk folded his arms. He spoke patiently, but did not meet her eyes.
"Will you not listen to me, lady? This last time? My advice is not half so bad as you make out, and you know it. How long will you listen to the honored words of this court beauty? You are like his little bird that he takes from the cage to play with, then puts back. He does not care for you."
"You are a strange person to talk of that, Brother Cadrach. The Earl has given us the captain's cabin, fed us at his own table, and treated me with complete respect."
Her heart sped a little as she remembered Aspytes' mouth at her ear, his firm, gentle touch.
"You, on the other hand, have lied to me, taken money for my freedom, and struck me senseless. Only a madman could put himself forward as the better friend after all that."
Now Cadrach did lift his eyes, holding her gaze for a long moment. He seemed to be looking for something, and his probing inspection brought warmth to her cheeks. She made a mocking face and turned away.
"Very well, lady," he said.
From the corner of his eye, she saw him shrug and walk off down the dock.
"It seems they teach little of kindness or forgiving in Osiris Church these days," he said over his shoulder.
Miriamel blinked back angry tears.
"You are the religious man, Cadrach, not me. If that is true, you are the best example."
She did not receive much pleasure from her own harsh rejoinder. When she had tired of watching the dockyard crowds, Miriamel went down to her cabin. The monk was sitting there, staring resolutely at nothing. Miriamel did not want to speak to him, so she turned and made her way above deck once more, then paced restlessly back and forth along the length of the Aedna cloud. Those of the ship's crew who had remained on board were refitting her for the outgoing voyage, some clambering in the rigging, checking the state of the sails, others effecting various small repairs here and there about the deck. This was to be their only night on Vinita, so the crewmen fairly flew through their tasks in a hurry to get ashore. Soon Miriamel found herself at the rail by the top of the gangplank, staring down once more at the eddying citizenry of the island. As the cool, moist wind ruffled her hair, she found herself thinking about what Cadrach had said. Could he be right? She knew that Aspytis had a flattering tongue, but could it be possible he did not care for her at all? Miriamel remembered their first night on deck, and the other sweet and secret kisses he had stolen from her since, and knew that the monk was wrong. She did not pretend that Aspytis loved her with all his soul. She doubted that her face tormented him at sleeping time, as his did to her. But she also knew beyond question that he was fond of her. And that was more than could be said of the other men she knew. Her father had wanted her to marry that horrible drunken braggart Fengbold, and her uncle Joshua had just wanted her to sit quietly and not cause him any trouble. But there was Simon, she thought, and felt a flicker of warmth cut through the grey morning. He had been sweet in his foolish way, yet brave as any of the noblemen she had seen. But he was a scullion, and she a king's daughter. And what did it matter anyway? They were on opposite sides of the world. They would never meet again. Something touched her arm, startling her. She whirled to find the wrinkled face of Gan Itte gazing up into hers. The Niski's usual look of wily good humor was absent.
Girl, I need to speak to you, the old one said.
What?
Something in the Niski's expression was alarming. I had a dream. A dream about you and about bad times. Gan Itte ducked her head, then turned and looked out to sea before turning back. The dream said, you were in danger, Miri...
The Niski broke off, looking past Miriamel's shoulder. The princess leaned forward. Had she misheard, or had Gan Itte been about to call her by her true name? But that could not be. No one beside Cadrach knew who she was, and she doubted that the monk would have told anyone on the ship. What such news might bring was too unpredictable, and Cadrach was trapped out on the ocean just as she was. No, it must have been only the Niski's odd way of speaking.
Oh, lovely lady,
a cheerful voice rang up from dockside.
It is a wet morning, but perhaps you would like to see Vinita.
Miriamel whirled. Aspytis stood at the base of the gangplank with his men-at-arms. The Earl wore a beautiful blue cloak and shiny boots. His hair danced in the wind.
Oh, yes, she said, pleased and excited. How wonderful it would be to get off this ship. I'll be right down.
When she turned, Gan Itte had vanished. Miriamel frowned slightly, puzzled. She suddenly thought of the monk sitting stone-faced in the cabin they shared, and felt a twinge of pity for him.
Shall I bring Brother Cadrach? She called down.
Aspytis laughed.
Certainly. We may find use in having a holy man with us, who can talk us out of temptations. That way, we may come back with a few kintis pieces left in our purses.
Miriamel ran downstairs to tell Cadrach. He looked at her oddly, but drew on his boots, then carefully chose just the right heavy cloak before following her back up the ladder. The wind rose, and the rain showers became heavier, although at first it was enough merely to walk along the busy waterfront, with the handsome, sociable Earl beside her. Soon Miriamel's excitement at being off the ship began to wear away. Despite the pushing crowd, Vinita's narrow street seemed sad and grey.
when Aspites bought her a chain of bluebells from a flower seller and tenderly hung them around her neck, she found it all she could do to smile for him.
"It is the weather," she guessed. "This unnatural weather has turned high summer into a dismal grey murk and put the cold right into my bones."
She thought of her father sitting alone in his room, and of the chilly, distant face he sometimes wore, like a mask that he had come to wear more and more frequently in her last months in the Hayholt.
"Cold bones and cold hearts," she sang quietly to herself,
as the Earl of Aedna led his party down Venita's rain-slicked byways.
"Cold bones and cold hearts lie in the rain in battle's wake, on chilly beach by Clodagh Lake, till Aedan's trumpet calls."
Just before noon, Aspites took them into an eating hall, where Miriamele immediately felt her flagging spirits begin to revive. The hall had a high ceiling, but the three large fire pits kept it warm and cheery, while at the same time filling the air with smoke and the smell of roasting meat. Many others had decided the hall might be a good place to be on this bitter morning. The rafters echoed with the tumult of diners and drinkers. The master of the hall and his several assistants were being worked to the utmost, thumping jugs of beer and bowls of wine onto the wooden tables, then snatching the proffered coins in a single continuous movement. A crude stage had been set up at the hall's far end. At the moment, a boy was juggling between acts of a puppet play, doing his best to keep several sticks in the air while suffering the drunken jests of spectators, using his feet, his only available extremities, to stop the occasional coin that came bouncing up onto the stage.
"Will you have something to eat, fair lady?" Aspites asked.
When Miriamele nodded shyly, he dispatched two of his men-at-arms. His other guardsmen unceremoniously removed a large family from one of the pitted tables. Soon the original pair of soldiers returned with a crackling haunch of lamb, bread, onions, and a generous supply of wine. A bowlful soon drove away much of Miriamele's chill, and she found that the morning's walk had given her a considerable appetite. The noon bell had scarcely rung before her food was gone. She readjusted her position on the seat, trying to avoid an unladylike belch.
"Look," she said, "they're starting the puppet play. Can we watch?"
"Certainly," Aspites said, waving his hand generously. "Certainly. You will forgive me if I do not come with you. I have not finished my meal. Besides, it looks like an Osiris play. You will not think me disrespectful if I say that, living in the lap of Mother Church, I see them frequently enough, in all varieties, from the grandest to the meanest."
He turned and signaled one of his men to accompany her.
"It is not a good idea for a well-dressed, gentle lady like yourself to go unprotected among the milling crowd."
"I am done eating," Cadrach said, standing. "I will come too, Lady Maria."
The monk fell in beside the Earl's guardsman. The play was in full swing. The spectators, especially the children, shrieked with delight as the puppets capered and smacked each other with their slapping sticks. Miriamele, too, laughed as Osiris tricked Crixus into bending over, then delivered a kick in the seat to the evil imperator. But her smile soon faded. Instead of his usual horns, Crixus wore what looked like a crown of antlers. For some reason, this filled her with unease. There was also something panicky and desperate in Osiris' high-pitched voice, and the puppet's painted, upturned eyes seemed unutterably sad. She turned to find Cadrach looking at her somberly.
"So we labor to build our little dams,"
the monk said, barely audible above the shouting throng,
"while the waters rise all around us."
He made the sign of the tree above his grey vestments. Before she could ask him what he meant, a rising howl from the crowd drew her attention back to the puppet stage. Osiris had been caught and hung wrong side up on the execution tree, wooden head dangling. As Crexis the goat prodded the helpless savior, another puppet appeared, rising from the darkness. This one was clothed all in orange and red tatters of cloth. As it swayed from side to side in an eerie dance, the rags swirled as though the puppet were covered with licking flames. Its head was a black, faceless knob, and it carried a small wooden sword the color of mud.
"Here comes the fire dancer to throw you down into the dark earth," Crexis squealed.
The Imperator did a little dance of joy.
"I do not live by the sword," the puppet Osiris said. "A sword cannot harm that which is God within me, that which is silence and peace."
Miriamel almost believed she could see its motionless lips mouthing the words.
"You can be silent forever, then, and worship your God in pieces,"
the Imperator shouted triumphantly as the faceless fire dancer began to hack with its sword. The laughing, screaming crowd grew louder, a sound like hounds at the kill. Miriamel felt dizzy, taken as though with a sudden fever. Fear growing within her, she turned away from the stage. Cadrach no longer stood beside her. Miriamel turned to the guardsman on the other side. The soldier, seeing her questioning look, whirled in search of the monk. Cadrach was nowhere to be seen. A search of the eating hall by Aspites and his men turned up no trace of the Hernesteer man. The Earl marched his party back to the Aedhna cloud through the windswept streets, his furious mood mirroring the angry skies. He was silent all the long walk back to the ship. Sinetris, the fisherman, looked the new arrival up and down. The stranger was a full head taller than him, broad as a gate, and soaking wet from the rain that hammered on the ceiling of the boat store. Sinetris weighed the advantages and disadvantages of circling slowly around this newcomer, until he could address the man from outside the tiny shelter. The disadvantages of such a plan were clear. It was the kind of day to day that made even the hardiest shiver by the fire and praise God for roofs. Also, it was Sinetris's own stall. And it seemed terribly unfair that he should have to go outside, so that this stranger could growl and champ and suck up all the air, while the fisherman stood miserably in the storm. The advantages, however, were equally clear. If he were outside, Sinetris could run for his life when this panting madman finally became murderous.
"I don't know what you're saying, father. There are no boats out today. You see how it is."
Sinetris gestured out at the sheeting rain, flung almost sideways by the force of the wind. The religious man stared at him furiously. The gigantic monk, if that was indeed what he was, had gone quite red and mottled in the face, and his eyebrows twitched. Strangely enough, Sinetris thought the monk seemed to be growing a beard. His whiskers were longer than even a week's razorless travel would cause. To the best of the fisherman's knowledge, Aedhnite monks did not wear beards. Then again, this one was some kind of barbarous northerner by his accent, a Rimmer's man or some such. Sinetris supposed that those born beyond the river Glenywent would be capable of just about any eccentricity. As he looked at the ragged whiskers and the chafed pink skin gleaming beneath, his unwholesome opinion of the monk grew more pronounced. This was definitely a man with whom to have as little to do as possible.
"I don't think you understand me, fisherman," the monk hissed, leaning forward and squinting in a truly frightening way. "I have come nearly through hell itself to get this far. I'm told that you are the only one who would take his boat out in such bad weather, and that the reason is because you overcharge."
A beefy hand closed on Sinetris' arm, occasioning a squeal of shock.
"Splendid. Cheat me. Rob me. I don't care. But I'm going down coast to Quanetupol, and I'm tired of asking people to take me. Do you understand?"
But you could go overland,"
Sinetra squeaked. This is no weather to be on the water.
And how long would it take to go overland from here?
A day? Two, perhaps? Not long. The monk's grip on his arm tightened cruelly.
You lie, little man. In this weather, through that marshy ground, it would take me a solid fortnight. But you're rather hoping I'll try, though, aren't you? Hoping I'll go away and sink into the mud somewhere?
An unpleasant smile flitted across the monk's broad face.
No, father, no. I would never think so of a holy man.
That's strange. Because your fellow fishermen tell me you've cheated everyone. Monks and priests by the score among them. Well, you shall have your chance to help a man of God, and you shall have your just and more than ample payment.
Sinetris burst into tears, impressing even himself.
But, Eminence, we truly dare not go out in such weather.
As he said it, he realized that for once he was telling the truth, and not merely trying to raise his price. This was weather that only a fool would brave. His pleading took on a note of greater desperation.
We will drown! You, God's holiest priest, and poor Sinetris, hard-working husband and father to 7 lovely children.
You have no children, and pity the woman who will ever be your wife. I talked to your fishing fellows, don't you remember? You are the scum that even Perdruin the mercenary has driven from her shores. Now, name your price, damn you. I must get to Quernitupol as soon as possible.
Sinetris sniffled a bit to give himself time to think. The standard ferrying charge was 1 kinnis, but with rough weather, and they certainly had that today, with no exaggeration, 3 or even 4 kinnis would not be out of line.
3 gold imperators!
He waited for the bellow of anger. When none came, he thought for a delirious moment he might have made his summer's income in 2 days. Then he saw the pink face drawing close, until the monk's breath was hot on his cheeks.
You worm, the monk said softly. There is a difference between simple robbery and rape. I think I should just fold you up like a napkin and take the damnable boat, leaving a gold imperator for your imaginary widow and 7 non-existent brats, which is more than the whole leaky thing is worth.
2 gold imperators, Eminence, 1 for my widow, 1 to purchase a mansa for my poor soul at the church.
1. And you know that
the sovereign remedies of the Rana healers should be forced into the care of a dryland butcher.
Anyway, I am lucky I kept my leg, he growled. Besides, you moved me out of the best accommodation quickly enough.
Tiamak waved his thin arm at the nest of blankets he now shared with Kealio, the simple-minded doorkeeper. The innkeeper's frown turned into a smirk.
Aren't you very high and cocksure for a marsh man? We'll get on with you then. Go to some other inn and see if they'll treat a Rana man as kindly as Caristra has.
Tiamak choked back a furious reply. He knew he must not let his anger get the better of him. He was being dreadfully cheated by this woman. But that was how things always went, when Rana men put their fortunes in the hands of drylanders. He had already failed his tribe, on whose behalf he had sworn to go to Naban and argue their case against higher tribute. If he were thrown out of Pelipa's bowl, he would fail Morghani's as well, who had explicitly asked for him to stay at this inn until he was needed. Tiamak offered a short prayer for patience to he who always steps on sand. If his staying in such a place was so important to Denevan and Morghani's, couldn't they at least have sent him money with which to pay for it? He took a deep breath, hating to grovel before this red-faced woman.
"It is foolish to fight, good lady," he said finally. "I am still expecting that my friend will show up, bringing more gold."
Tiamak forced himself to smile.
"Until then, I think I still have some little bit of my two imperators remaining. Surely it is not all spent quite yet. If I have to leave, someone else will be earning gold for giving their best accommodations to me and my friend."
She stared at him for a moment, weighing the advantages of throwing him out against the possibility of future money gouging.
"Well," she said grudgingly, "perhaps out of the goodness of my heart, I could let you stay another 3 days. But no meals, mind you. You'll have to come up with more coins, or else find your own food. I set a lavish table for my guests, and can't afford to give it away."
Tiamak knew that the lavish table consisted mostly of thin soup and dried bread, but also knew that even such meager fare was better than nothing. He would have to feed himself somehow. He was used to going long on little provender, but he was still quite weak from his leg wounds and resulting illness. How he would love to bounce a sling stone off this woman's mocking face.
"Very fair, my lady," he gritted his teeth. "Very fair. My friends always say I'm too good."
Caristra swaggered back into the common room, leaving Tiamak to cover his head with his odoriferous blanket and contemplate the grim state of his affairs. Tiamak lay sleeplessly in the dark. His mind was spinning, but he could think of no solution to his problems. He could barely walk. He was stranded without resources in a strange place, among banded drylanders. It seemed that they who watch and shape had conspired to torment him. The old man Kaelio grunted in his sleep, and rolled over, his long arm flopping heavily against Tiamak's face. Painfully thumped, the Ranaman moaned and sat up. It was no use being upset with the ancient simpleton. Kaelio was no more to blame for their uncomfortable proximity than was Tiamak himself. The Ranaman wondered if Kaelio was upset at having to share his bed. But somehow he doubted it. The cheerful old man was as guileless as a child. He seemed to accept everything that came his way, blows, kicks, and curses included, as acts of fate, unfathomable and unavoidable as thunderstorms. Thinking of evil weather, Tiamak shivered. The hovering storm that had turned the air of the Ran and all the southern coast hot and sticky as broth had fallen at last, drenching Quenitupul in unseasonable rains. The normally placid canals had turned choppy and unpredictable. Most ships rode at anchor, slowing the business of the thriving port city to a crawl. The heavy storm had also nearly choked off the flow of new visitors, which was another reason for Caristra's unpleasantness. Tonight the rain had stopped for the first time in several days. Not long after Tiamak had crawled into his insufficient bed, the constant rattle on the roof had suddenly gone silent, a silence so deep it seemed almost like another noise. Perhaps, he thought, it was this unaccustomed silence that made it so hard to sleep. Shivering again, Tiamak tried to pull his blanket closer about him, but the old man beside him had caught up the whole tangle in a death grip. Despite his advanced age, the fool seemed to be a great deal stronger than Tiamak, who even before his unfortunate brush with the crocodile had never been robust, even by the standards of his small-boned people. The Ranaman ceased struggling for the covers. Kaelio gurgled and murmured in the throes of some dream of past happiness. Tiamak frowned. Why had he ever left his house in the banyan tree, in his beloved, familiar swamp? It was not much, but it was his. And unlike this drafty, damp boathouse, it had always been warm. This was more than just night cold, he realized suddenly, racked by more shivers.
There was a chill in the air that pierced the chest like daggers. He initiated another doomed struggle for blankets, then sat up again in despair. Perhaps the door had been left open. Giving vent to a full-throated groan of anguish, he crawled away from his bed, forcing himself to stand. His leg throbbed and burned. The tosspot healer had said that his poultices would take the pain away soon enough, but Tiamak had little faith in such an obvious drunkard. And so far his doubts had been borne out. He limped slowly across the rough wood floor, doing his best to avoid the two upended boats that dominated the room. He managed to stay near the wall, and thus evade these large obstacles. But a hard stool leaped up before him and cruelly battered his good shin, so that for a moment Tiamak had to stop and bite his lip as he rubbed the leg, holding in a screech of pain and anger that he feared would have no ending. Why had he and he alone been singled out for such ill treatment? When he could walk once more, he continued with even more care, so that his journey to the door seemed to take hours. When he reached it at last, he discovered to his immense disappointment that the door was shut. There seemed little more he could do to prevent himself from spending a sleepless and freezing night. As he thumped his hand against the frame in frustration, the door swung open to reveal the empty pier outside, a dim grey rectangle in the moonlight. A blast of chill air rolled over him, but before he could grasp the elusive handle and pull the door closed again, something caught his eye. Baffled, he took a couple of limping steps out through the doorway. There was something odd about the fine mist that floated down through the moonlight. A long moment passed before Tiamak realized that it was not rain that dotted his outstretched palm, but rather tiny flakes of white. He had never seen this thing before. No Rannaman ever had. But he was unusually well-read, and had also heard it described many times in his student days. It took only a moment for him to understand the significance of the downy flakes, and the vapor that rose from his own lips to drift and dissipate on the night air. Snow was falling on Quenetupel, in the heart of summer. Miriamel lay in her bed in darkness and wept until she was too tired to weep any longer. As Aedna Cloud rocked at anchor in Venita's harbour, she felt loneliness pressing down on her like a great weight. It was not so much Cadrach's betrayal, despite her moments of weakness toward him. The monk had shown his true colours long ago. It was rather that he was her last link with her true self, with her past life. As if an anchor rope had been cut, she felt herself suddenly adrift in a sea of strangers. Cadrach's desertion had not been a complete surprise. So little good feeling remained between the two of them that it seemed only circumstance had kept him from deserting her earlier. She looked back on the cool deliberateness he had shown in selecting his traveling cloak before they left the boat, and saw that he had clearly anticipated this escape, at least from the moment they had been summoned down to Venita. In a way, he had tried to warn her, hadn't he? On the deck, he had asked her to listen, saying, "This last time." The monk's betrayal was unsurprising, but the pain was no less heavy for that. A long-anticipated blow had fallen at last. Desertion and indifference, that seemed to be the thread that ran through her life. Her mother had died, her father had changed into something cold and uncaring. Her uncle Joshua had only wished her out of his way. He would deny it, no doubt, but it had been plain in his every word and expression. For a while she had thought Denevan and his master, the Lector, could shelter her, but they had died and left her friendless. Although she knew it was not even remotely their fault, she still could not forgive. No one would help her. The kinder ones like Simon and the Troll, or dear old Duke Iskrimnor, were absent or powerless. Now Cadrach too had left her. There must be something inside of her that pushed others away, Miriamel brooded, some stain like the dark discoloration in the white stone canals of Merrimond, hidden until the tide went out, or maybe it was not in her at all, but in the souls of those around her, those who could not stay rooted to obligation, who could not remember their duty to a young woman. And what of Aspites, the Golden Earl? She had little hope that he would prove more responsible than the others, but at least he cared for her, at least he wanted her for something. Perhaps when it was all over, when her father had reshaped the world, in whatever way pleased his corrupt fancy, she would be able to find a home somewhere. She would be happy with a small house by the sea, would gladly shed her unwanted royalty like an old snakeskin. But until then, what should she do? Miriamel rolled over and pushed her face into the rough blanket, feeling the bed and the entire ship moving in the sea's gentle but insistent grip. It was all too much, too many thoughts, too many questions. She felt quite strengthless. She wanted only to be held, to be protected, to let time slip away until she could wake into a better world. She cried quietly, fretfully, anchorless on the edge of sleep. The afternoon slipped past. Miriamel lay in the darkness of her cabin, wandering in and out of dreams. Somewhere above, the lookout cried sunset. No other sound intruded but the lap of waves and the muffled cry of seabirds. The ship was all but deserted, the sailing men ashore in Veneta. Miriamel was not surprised when the cabin door quietly opened at last, and a weight pressed down on the bed beside her. Aspites' finger traced her features. Miriamel turned away, wishing she could pull the shadows over her like a blanket, wishing she were a child again, living beside an ocean that was still innocent of kilpa, an ocean upon whose waves storms touched only lightly and disappeared at the sun's golden rising.
"My lady," he whispered, "ah, I am so sorry. You have been badly treated."
Miriamel said nothing, but his voice seemed a soothing balm to her painful thoughts. He spoke again, telling her of her beauty and kindness. In her feverish sadness, the words were little more than nonsense, but his voice was sweet and reassuring. She felt calmed by it, gentled like a nervous horse. When he slid beneath the sheet, she felt his skin against hers, warm and smooth and firm. She murmured in protest, but softly, with no real strength. In a way, this too seemed a kindness. His mouth was at her neck,